This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
There's no reason to buy a V12 supercar when an electric one can outperform it and operate incredibly cheaper.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we dig into the archives to first speak with author and Bloomberg Opinion columnist Adam Minter about the world of autonomous vehicles. We examine the impact autonomous vehicles might have on rural America, look at an appealing test program in a sparsely populated area of Minnesota, and explore how the elimination of drivers might assist those who cannot or should not be driving. Then we hear from automotive journalist Jim Motovalli to discuss the puzzling decision by General Motors to shelve the Chevy Bolt, get some recommendations on new EV automakers and models, and talk about America's ongoing fascination with big old gas-guzzling trucks and SUVs. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Adam Minter. Adam is a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, and he is an author whose most recent book is Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Adam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I've wanted to speak to you for a long time because you've been an important voice in not only covering the recycling and garbage space, but in China and where those topics intersect. But today, I wanted to talk to you about a topic that is one that I'm personally quite interested in, and you had an angle on it that I thought was one that hadn't really been explored. The piece on Bloomberg Opinion is entitled, "Self-Driving Cars Are a Natural Fit for Rural America." Usually, we think of self-driving cars as an urban transport solution, but you were able to kind of look at it differently. Why don't you explain the thesis of your piece, if you will?
Sure. Well, I had learned, about a month ago about a pilot program in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, which is about 180 miles north of Minneapolis, where they were running autonomous robo-taxi shuttles. I've been to Grand Rapids. It's a town of just over 11,000 people. And that threw me because, as you just indicated, we usually think of autonomous vehicles, EVs, as something that, roams around flat places, warm places, test tracks in Silicon Valley or in Phoenix, Arizona. And I found it interesting, and it immediately clicked with me why this might work. And if you spend time in rural America, it might occur to you as well. Rural America is aging. And it is also becoming increasingly disabled. Now, that's not to say that everybody is disabled, but, about 20% of rural America is over the age of 65 compared to 16% across the United States in general. That's a big gap. And when you have aging people, I have aging parents, they eventually have to give up the car keys, whether they want to or not. And that means they need alternative rides. Those rides are easier to procure in cities. But in the countryside, in rural areas, in places like Grand Rapids, they're both difficult to procure, even though there is public transit, and they're expensive and they're irregular. And so it is an opportunity, in theory, for autonomous vehicles to come in and do what some of these expensive rural transit options are doing for a lot of money, maybe doing them for equal or less.
So are we thinking for somebody like, let's say, an 80-year-old retiree who can't drive anymore, would that person hypothetically be buying their own autonomous vehicle, or would they be able to access a more affordable taxi that would they'd be more available because of the limitations of having taxi cab drivers on call in rural America?
Right. It's a great question. In addition to being older, rural America is poorer. Now, it's not necessarily poor, though some communities are. But on balance, there's going to be fewer people in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, who can afford an autonomous Tesla, say, than one in Silicon Valley. So the idea in these rural communities, and it's not just Grand Rapids that's thinking about this. Grand Rapids is testing it out. You have communities in France and Japan with aging countrysides as well, where they're saying an autonomous taxi, robo-taxi, that can be called on demand is really maybe the business model that we want. It will require subsidies, but public transit always requires subsidies. But those subsidies, in theory at least, if it's on demand and it's not driving around with a lot of empty passengers all day long, it can help provide transport for this aging community, this disabled community, at a lower price point or equal price point.
And at a much nicer, more comfortable ride. And it's also worth noting that these vehicles would almost always be electric, so there'd be lower emissions. You mentioned in the piece how the bus system in, I think it was in Grand Rapids, somebody's route would be over at 3:30 in the afternoon or something like that. So we think of like, oh, you take the bus into town to go to the grocery store. Not so simple, though.
No, not at all. And that's just it. I mean, when you have a community of 11,000 people, that's Grand Rapids, in the middle of this huge county, Itasca County, provide, you know, where the population is very dispersed, it's extremely expensive to run bus routes. And those, you know, you can't have the number of bus routes that you would have, say, in Minneapolis or in a more densely populated place like New York City. It's only a few. They go very infrequently and they end. For example, on Fridays, and I reference this really at the top of my piece, the last ride in or out of the only hospital in town departs the hospital at 3:20, arrives and departs at 3:20 p.m. Well, if you have a late afternoon non-emergency or emergency appointment, you're going to have to find another way to get home. The bus is relatively cheap, you know, it's a bus fare. But if you don't have a ride home, then it's going to be, you're going to be talking about medical transport potentially, which could be, you know, well over $100. You could be talking about a taxi, you know, which could be dozens of dollars, I guess we could say. And if you're a senior on a fixed income, you know, that's a real hit. You can't get around. So having an on-demand system, and these are ride shares. It's not just somebody coming and picking you up and taking you somewhere. You may be picking somebody else up on the way in these autonomous vehicles. That's how it works with the Go Marty program in Grand Rapids. But again, it provides more flexibility for the seniors so that they can get, or anybody really, but it's focused a lot on seniors in the disabled community, so they can get around to these places like the hospital, like community gatherings, like family gatherings, and it improves their quality of life as well.
When I was reading the piece, one of the stories that was also popping up in the news was this record-setting cold snap that's going through the country. I couldn't help but think that a disabled person taking an autonomous vehicle in inclement weather could be at risk if they don't have a driver, if they're kind of just on their own with this robo-car. What kind of safety precautions are being put in place to ensure their safety?
Well, this is a pilot. I mean, it's a demonstration project, and the state of Minnesota is paying for half of it. And one of the reasons they're paying for half of it is because they want to see how these autonomous vehicles do in winter conditions in Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. I learned to drive on snowy, icy roads. And so, it was one of the attractions for me of the story. I really wanted to see how these autonomous vehicles handled it. The good news.
So you went in them.
Oh, yeah. No, I rode around for part of an afternoon and an evening just trying these things out on icy roads in cold conditions. The good news for anybody who's worried about safety is, one, when the state of Minnesota and Grand Rapids and everybody hired on May Mobility to do this, that's the name of the company that's actually providing the service, safety was one of the top criteria. They wanted to make sure this was safe. One of the ways that they ensure safety is that they have what's called an operator sitting in the driver's seat of the vehicle, mostly with his, they're all men, I think so at least, with his hands off the wheel. But if something goes awry, he can grab the wheel, can put his foot on the brake pedal. And he does that. And then he hits what's called the log button so that, you know, because there's sensors all over this thing. So it logs whatever the issue was. And that's sent to the programmers in Ann Arbor, Michigan and in Minnesota so they can correct it. It was interesting for me as somebody who grew up driving on icy snow snowy roads. I have to say, I was grabbing the armrest a couple times watching this guy go down a snowy, icy hill. It did okay. There are a couple of situations still where they are required, the operators are required to take the wheel because this is a pilot. And these vehicles are learning. There's an AI component to this. It's only been going for 2 months. And if you talk to the operators, you know, they'll tell you the vehicles are learning. They're getting better on certain curves, you know, at roundabouts, taking certain turns. One of the anecdotes I thought was really interesting and illuminating was that two operators told me that the vehicle has started seeing deer about to jump into the road before the operators do, which is really important in northern Minnesota because deer strikes are a real danger on those roads. Even though these vehicles are only going, 35 miles an hour, I think at top speed, you don't want to hit a deer at 35 miles an hour, believe me. So they've learned to recognize those things. I also had a couple moments in these vehicles where the vehicles, the operator had to take over. At one point, one of the vehicles started veering off the road into sort of a snowy shoulder. It couldn't recognize where the shoulder was. A couple times there were hard brakes where it thought it saw something in the road. Vehicle exhaust in super cold weather, it creates big plumes. So that can confuse the computer. A story I told in the piece, I asked to be dropped off at a hardware store. I was driving this around town and it did drop me off at a hardware store, but it dropped me off at the snowbank, in front of the hardware store where a sidewalk is during, warm weather. So it's working out these kinks. It's learning how to handle them and May Mobility and the state of Minnesota, Go Marty, everybody very open that this is a learning process and it's the first, pilot of its kind with autonomous vehicles taking place in cold conditions like this.
I feel for the driver in the aftermath of a child who chased a ball across his path, or the ones involved and the most unloved. I feel for the driver. I feel for the soldier in the throes of war, sent off to settle someone else's score, for the ones involved and the most unloved. I feel for the soldier. Every story has two sides, every coin two faces. I feel for the one who hides and for the one who chases.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to journalist and author Adam Minter. So, Adam, we're talking about these self-driving vehicles. You mentioned how this would have to be subsidized. So how scalable is it? Is there a compelling business model for autonomous vehicles outside of densely populated areas in a long-term view?
Sure. Well, May Mobility, which again is they have designed the vehicles that are driving around Grand Rapids are Toyota Siennas that May Mobility works with Toyota. Toyota's one of its investors, and then they insert their software and they've got sensors and various equipment on them to operate them. And what May Mobility told me is, look, we are price competitive with the most inefficient transit options, bus services in rural America. We can do it for the same price, but we can give those people those rides, give them a better experience, meaning better on-time rates, more pickups, better service getting into the vehicles, if they're disabled, because three of these vehicles are wheelchair accessible. So they are price competitive with the least efficient, most expensive transit in rural America. That doesn't mean that the transit services, if they end up adopting these vehicles, will run a profit. But, transit doesn't run profits. The New York City subway doesn't run a profit either. It receives massive subsidies from the federal government, from state governments. And this program as well currently is half funded by the state of Minnesota. And then the other half comes from a range of local governments, Grand Rapids, Itasca County, private foundations, the Blandon Foundation, for a total of $3.6 million over 18 months. But again, that should be price competitive with the services that are otherwise offered inefficiently via bus. So that's kind of the business model. And then, you know, you can't think of it just in terms of profit and loss, but you also have to think of it in terms of the value it brings to a community. If you're getting seniors and disabled folks out of their homes more into other businesses, or just even going to the community centers, you know, what kind of value does that build for a community? And autonomous vehicles, at least what they're trying to figure out is, you know, will these autonomous vehicles bring that kind of value to Grand Rapids? And, you know, we're still only, you know, 2-3 months into this program, but the early indications are that it's been, an excellent success, and the target communities are finding that they're more mobile because of it.
He's a journalist and author for Bloomberg Opinion, Adam Minter. Adam, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm joined now on SeaChange Radio by Jim Motavalli. He is a freelance automotive journalist. He contributes to publications such as the New York Times, Barron's, Auto Week, TechCrunch. Jim, welcome back to SeaChange Radio.
Great to be on SeaChange Radio.
So we haven't had you on for a couple of years, but I wanted to dive into some of the evolution of the electric vehicle, the EV space with you. Last time we talked, Tesla was riding high. It was by far and away the biggest player in the space. But you were talking about some of these newer names like Rivian coming around to compete with the Teslas in the higher range. Why don't you first give us a progress report on some of these non-Tesla brands and how they stack up to the Teslas of the world?
Well, there's two things happening. One is all the mainstream automakers are introducing EVs, and those are hitting the market. And there are also the startups, and those include Rivian and Lucid, have gotten cars on the road, and they're starting to show up in dealerships and compete with Tesla. None of them have vehicles in sufficient quantities yet to challenge Tesla in the marketplace. I mean, Tesla is still by far the largest seller in the EV market. But I think in terms of quality and appeal, I think we're now seeing vehicles that rival Tesla. So their absolute and total dominance is kind of threatened by all these startups. There's companies like Bollinger that have launched and then gotten out of the market. Sono Motors was another one. I mean, there's several EV companies that have not made it, but I think at this point we can say that Rivian and Lucid are probably going to go the distance and have very credible vehicles. And I was just on a week-long ride and drive event with Lucid, and their cars are very, very impressive. But, you know, they're a startup, so you sort of have the, you know, the teething problems of a startup. They still haven't gotten their production in line with what they want it to be. I mean, still hard to get them.
Yes. How are numbers stacking up overall in terms of what experts were predicting 5 years ago in terms of the EV market share versus what it is today? When we're talking about production numbers, we're still far away from making that complete transition to an electric fleet, that's for sure. But why don't you give us an idea of kind of the dent that they've made?
EVs are something like 7% of the U.S. auto market right now. It's probably double that in California, which is the largest U.S. EV market. And I was just down in Florida. I couldn't believe how many EVs are on the road there. You wouldn't expect it. And I was in the Miami area, and there are so many Teslas on the road there. And I saw EVs of every stripe, even some that are fairly rare, like the, you know, the Mercedes EQS. And I even saw a Bollinger on the road down there. And I did find a fairly good availability of EV charging. We went to a national park, and you could charge your EV there. So there are pockets of strong EV sales in the country. The Northeast, the West, Florida, and Texas are all very good EV markets. But like I said, it's still less than 10% of sales. However, just about every automaker is going to stop making internal combustion vehicles by 2035 at the latest. So then it's not a question of, well, should I buy an internal combustion car or an EV? There won't be any gas cars or diesel cars on the road.
Well, they'll be on the road, but they won't be getting sold.
Yeah, well, they won't be available to buy except as used cars. And, you know, there won't be any new internal combustion engines. And a number of states, as well as Europe as a whole, the European Union, have said no electric or no gas car sales after 2035. California then joined that, and New York and a number of other states are now on board with that. So you would not be able to buy gas cars, new gas cars, in a number of states by 2035, or all of Europe, or, you know, significant parts of the other rest of the world. I think probably China is not going to be selling gas cars either.
So what's driving this transformation? Is it policy? Is it the market?
I think it's the market, in the sense that the vehicles are going to be better than the gas cars. The electric vehicles have many advantages, including in terms of what, say, Car and Driver and Motor Trend and Road and Track care about, which is performance. It's the electric cars that can go 0 to 60 in 1.9 seconds. It's the Tesla Model S Plaid Edition. It's the Lucid Air Sapphire Edition. It's the there's at least a couple other ones. The electric motor has 100% torque at 0 RPM, so it just takes off from a standing start. It's incredibly fast that way. And I think when the Tesla Model S came out, suddenly it became an independent object of desire. People said, I want one of those. They weren't thinking, oh, I got to be green, I got to eat the spinach or whatever. They said, this is actually cool. This is something I want. That had to happen before I think EVs could take off. But now, to me, the supercar is dead in internal combustion form. There's no reason to buy a V12 supercar when an electric one can outperform it and operate incredibly cheaper.
So, Jim, the Chevy Bolt is General Motors' best-selling electric vehicle. They delivered 20,000 EVs in the U.S. in the last quarter, and it's had some problems along the way, some bumps and some very expensive recalls, but they just announced that they're shutting down the brand. What should people who are following the EV space make of this?
Well, General Motors may be killing the Bolt, but they're doubling down on EVs. See, the reality of the market is that 80% of the market wants to buy SUVs. So pretty much all the vehicles that are on the drawing board, you take a company like, I don't know, Bentley or Lamborghini or one of those. When they come out with an SUV, no matter how crazy it is for their brand concept, it invariably becomes their best-selling vehicle. And automakers recognize that. You know, the popularity of small hatchbacks is been waning for a long time. It's like 5% of the market or something. So the Bolt is a small car, and I think that's pretty much why they killed it. But they're not giving up on EVs just because they're getting rid of that. They killed the Volt also, their plug-in hybrid, which was also very pioneering. But, you know, I think some of the things that GM has done, some of the vehicles I just don't understand, like the Hummer EV, the pickup and SUV versions of those, how big a battery you have to put in those things and how heavy the vehicles get. The Hummer EV weighs 9,600 pounds. And yeah, it's really fast, and I'm sure it can go off-road and all that, but it just, I think that's the wrong way to go. We should make EVs as light as possible so they need the fewest amount of battery. Everything I've seen of Rivian, I like what the company does. It's just their vehicles are not in my demographic. I don't really want to own a big, heavy pickup truck or off-roading SUV. It's just not, I don't care about that.
Thank you. know that don't seem right.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to automobile expert Jim Motovalli. So, Jim, let's dive into what's behind this fascination that American drivers have with large cars. It's not a global fascination, is it? This is uniquely American, wanting to have these big SUVs. I know that there are bigger cars elsewhere, but there's no other country that has this percentage of its fleet being large scale trucks and SUVs. Is there another country like this?
I would say not. But, you know, fuel in the U.S. is cheaper than it is just about anywhere else in the world, except maybe in Saudi Arabia. I think it's pretty cheap there.
But it's more than that. It was like, what, 30 years of marketing, right? This Chevy like a rock and Ford F-150s, tough, and all these marketing things that just have been battering us for decades, and it's effective.
Well, let me make a point here, Alex. Maybe it's contrary to the trend you're talking about. If you go back to the start of the SUV craze, it was when Jeep started selling a lot of Cherokees and Wranglers and stuff. And the Jeep brand at that point was at a fairly low ebb. And at one point it was owned by Renault, the French company. And they sold it to Chrysler. It was part of AMC also. And the Renault sold AMC, including, you know, American Motors and Jeep, to Chrysler. And it wasn't even that expensive. And the main thing Chrysler wanted was this plant in Canada that was state of the art, came with a deal. They didn't regard the Jeep brand as any sort of great prize because it wasn't selling that much.
They wanted the AMC Pacer, huh?
Pretty much. No, I don't think they wanted the Pacer either. But anyway, they didn't pay that much for it. So they ended up with Jeep. And then they noticed that people were starting to buy four-wheel drive vehicles. The companies started to notice that and they started to encourage it. But I'm saying the trend to buying these off-road vehicles and sort of as an image thing, I think it was actually initiated by consumers rather than by a marketing push, though it was immediately capitalized on and expanded by the marketing people. And it feeds into some sort of desire on the part of Americans to feel like they're adventurous, they're different from the herd, and you know they can go off-road. It's nonsense because only like 10% of SUVs ever leave the road anyway, but it's the potential, it's the ideas.
Jim Motovalli. Jim, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You bet, Alex, anytime.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, Ron Sexsmith, and Muddy Waters. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.